Hello, everyone. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravolima Foxtrot. I'm reading for you today in digest format here on the Courage Handy Ham System, CQ Magazine for the month of July, 2010. CQ is a publication of CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address, in lowercase, one word, Handy Ham, spelled H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M, Handy Ham, at courage.org. Website, www.handyham.org. We'll begin today with the ham radio news. Federal Communications Commission proposes changes to the 60-meter band. The FCC has proposed a frequency swap, a power increase, and permission to use CW and certain digital modes on 60 meters, the secondary amateur allocation at 5 megahertz. Responding to a petition for rulemaking filed by the ARRL in 2006, the FCC's Notice of Proposed Rulemaking in ET Docket 10-98 proposes substituting 5358.5 kHz for the current channel at 5368 kHz, which often is unusable by hams due to its frequent use by one of the band's primary users, the fixed service in this case. It also proposes permitting the use of Morse code, PSK31 and PAC-TOR 3, no other digital modes, on the band as well as upper sideband voice. It asks for comments on the ARRL proposal to mandate time limits on transmissions using these other modes in order to minimize delays in clearing the frequency if the federal agency, another primary user, needs to make a transmission. It also seeks comments on an ARRL proposal, for the same reason, to mandate the use of VOX, that's voice-operated switching, on voice communications on the band. Finally, the Commission proposes increasing the maximum power permitted on 60 meters from the current 50 watts ERP, effective radiated power, to 100 watts ERP. At press time, comment deadline has not yet been set. Radio Kuwait vacates 7150, 7190 kHz. All international broadcasters were supposed to have moved their 41-meter operations above 7200 kHz as of last year. But apparently not everyone has gotten the message. When a shortwave station appeared on 7150 and 7190 kHz in April, the International Amateur Radio Union's Intruder Watch monitoring system went to work. According to the ARRL letter, the station was quickly identified as Radio Kuwait, while IARU monitors began filing formal complaints with their country's telecommunications authorities. Kuwait's IARU monitoring system coordinator, Faisal Al-Amdi, 9K2RR, contacted Radio Kuwait directly. A few days later, he reported that the station's general manager of engineering had informed him that all transmissions on 7150 and 7190 kHz had been suspended. Mission to Venus launched ham's help request. A Japanese-built CubeSat is on its way to Venus, and hams are being asked to take part in receiving its signals and in designing related experiments. The Unitech 1 satellite was launched from Japan on May 20, and it carries an amateur-rated telemetry beacon transmitting CW on 5.840 GHz. American ham William Vartarola, KJ40RX, has been working with a consortium of Japanese universities that designed and built the satellite and has set up the FlyVenus.com website to try to coordinate ham participation. One goal is to have hams around the world monitor the very slow CW beacon. It's one byte per second, and combined the received signals to improve the signal-to-noise ratio. Bartarola says the team is also interested in ideas and experiments related to receiving these very weak signals, and is particularly interested in one-page research proposals that he can forward to Japan. For more information, you could go to the following website, http://www.flyvenus.com. That's www.flyvenus.com. Or contact KJ4ORX via email at, in lowercase, GLOBEBIZ at JUNO. That's GlobeBiz, one little word, at Juno.com. Another study fails to find cell phone cancer link. An international study of possible links between cell phone use and brain cancer has, once again, returned inconclusive results. This study, the largest conducted to date, involved 21 doctors in 13 countries and nearly 13,000 participants, and was conducted over a period of 10 years. The International Agency for Research on Cancer, part of the World Health Organization, conducted the research. Its report said there were suggestions that using cell phones for more than 30 minutes per day might increase the risk of one type of cancer, glioma. That's spelled G-L-I-O-M-A, but that, quoting here, biases and error prevented researchers from establishing a causal link between cell phones and cancer. In one group studied, cancer rates were actually lower than in the general population, but the researchers dismissed those statistics as being based on, quoting, implausible values of reported use in this group, close quote. While a panel found that an increased risk of brain cancer is not established from the data, the researchers concluded that further research is needed. And here's an editor's note. After all, they need job security. Hi. Chinese hams stand down from earthquake relief. After more than a month of helping to provide relief to earthquake victims in China's Qinghai province, hams working with the Chinese Radio Sports Association, the acronym is CRSA, have wrapped up their operations according to the ARRL letter. Unlike the more segmented response to disasters in the United States, each ham radio team traveling to the quake zone transported relief supplies along with its radio gear, and volunteers were involved in more than just providing communications. According to the report from CRSA, one team of hams from Beijing was directly responsible for saving six people. The April 14 quake was the second major earthquake to hit China in 2 years. The CRSA officials said lessons learned from the 2008 event were put to good use in this response. Police blotter. Dum da dum dum. Two hams in trouble with the law. An Ohio ham arrested in North Carolina was due in court on June 10 to respond to misdemeanor charges in connection with potentially threatening behavior toward President Obama. Joseph Sean McVie, K8JSM, of Coshocton, Ohio, was arrested in Asheville, North Carolina's airport in late April just after the president took off aboard Air Force One. According to the Asheville Citizen Times newspaper, McVie was carrying a loaded handgun for which he had a permit, and his car was equipped with strobe lights and a siren, in addition to a variety of scanners and rifle scope formulas. He reportedly told police he wanted to see the president. McVie was charged with the misdemeanor offense of going armed to the terror of the public. That was a quote. And was released on bail 2 days after his arrest. Meanwhile, in Southern California, Irene Marie Levy, called KJ6CEY, has pleaded not guilty to felony charges relating to transmission C allegedly made on police and fire frequencies. According to the Southwest Riverside News Network, Police allege that Levy transmitted bomb threats, jammed emergency service frequencies, and interrupted radio traffic. She was charged with making criminal threats and making a false bomb report, both felonies, as well as misdemeanor counts of maliciously interrupting a communications transmission and obstructing arrest. Let's move along now to the CQ editorial by the editor Rich Mawson, called W2VU. This editorial in Zero Bias is titled, Could RF Be Good for Your Health? Two interesting medical studies crossed my desk in the week after I returned from the Dayton Hamvention, and both of them got me thinking about something I'd noticed while at Dayton. The first was reported in my local newspaper with the headline, Study is Inconclusive on Cell Phones, Cancer. The second, reported by Science Daily, said new evidence suggests that caffeine may slow the progress of Alzheimer's disease and other types of dementia. The cell phone study, the largest ever undertaken to date, was conducted by the International Agency for Research on Cancer, a part of the United Nations World Health Organization. As with every other study on supposed health risks from radio frequency, RF, radiation, this one was unable to establish that cell phones cause cancer. In fact, one part of the study suggested that brain cancer rates were lower among cell phone users than the general population. But the researchers dismissed that finding as being based on implausible values of reported use. This brings up two questions. One, if one set of data is implausible, then how reliable is the rest? Two, what if that dismissal reflects researcher bias more than an anomaly in the data? In other words, what if the data are actually correct? True, that would go against the widely held assumption that RF exposure is bad for you, but the purpose of a scientific study is to objectively test such assumptions rather than to try to either confirm or refute them. Take, for example, the second study. For years, we've heard that caffeine is bad for you and that intake should be limited. Now, the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease reports on a study conducted in Portugal, which suggests that caffeine may actually provide protection against cognitive decline associated with Alzheimer's disease. Then there's chocolate. Bad for you, right? Well, except that current research is showing that some amount of chocolate, especially dark chocolate, eaten regularly, may actually have health benefits. So, what if the widely held assumption about the health effects of RF is wrong, like the previously widely held assumption about caffeine and chocolate? What if the researchers are approaching their studies from the wrong angle? I'd like to suggest a study on the potential positive health effects of long-term exposure to RF energy. Look around at your next club meeting or ham fest. How many hams do you see who have had many years of exposure to RF energy and who remain active and involved well into their 80s and even 90s? How many hams do you know with Alzheimer's disease? There are some, to be sure. But I'm willing to bet that the percentage is significantly lower than in the general population, even though we have a large number of older people in our population. I started thinking about this at Dayton, where author Walt Maxwell, called W2DU, spent several hours at the CQ booth signing copies of his newly published book titled Reflections 3 in Roman numerals, in which he completely revised and updated Reflections 2 in Roman numerals and added about 100 pages of new text. Walt is 91 years old and sharper mentally than I've ever been. Walt's fellow CQ book author, Jerry Sivak, called W2MFI, now a silent key, was likewise fully with it and active on the air until just before his passing last year at age 90. As we went to press, we learned that CQ contributor, Propagation Authority, and University of California at Berkeley Professor Emeritus of Physics Bob Brown, call NM7M, who has an article in this issue, which is titled Over Coffee and Cognac. Page 18 has also become a silent key on May 23 at age 87. While Bob developed physical limitations, his mind was sharp as a tack until the end. We TQ will miss him and his insatiable curiosity. I'm sure your own club or circle of ham radio acquaintances is similarly populated with a fair number of people who are well on in years and perhaps physically limited, but still mentally sharp and active on the air. Is it possible that decades of RF exposure have somehow given these people added longevity and perhaps some sort of protection against ailments such as Alzheimer's disease? Of course, the greater likelihood is that the continued mental acuity of so many hands is more closely linked to the fact that so many of us are insatiably curious, never stop learning, and keep our brains active. It is well established that brain health, like physical health, is best maintained and enhanced through regular exercise. But that does not account for the fact that a very large number of hams live well into their 80s and 90s. Is the percentage greater than the general population? If so, what accounts for it? It would make an interesting study. And now to conclude with a little bit of Dayton musings. Dayton itself was its usual 3 days of semi-organized chaos. A couple of us were observing that the hamvention is somewhat like ham radio itself. No matter how hectic and disorganized it may appear to be to observers, somehow or other, it always works. It's not always clear how or why it works, but it does. This year it seemed that attendance was up a little over last year, which in turn was up a little over the previous year. Most of the vendors we talked to reported higher sales, some significantly so. Without getting overly optimistic, it appears that both the overall economy and the ham radio economy may have turned the corner and begun to recover. We certainly hope this lasts. My thanks to our columnists, award managers, and contest directors who helped out at the CQ booth. And congratulations again to CQ publisher Dick Ross, K2MGA, who was honored in front of his peers at the CQ Industry Reception with the Hamventions 2010 Special Achievement Award in recognition of his 50 years of leadership of the ham radio hobby and industry. 73, W2VU. Let's go now to announcements. There's a special event station in the state of Massachusetts. It's N1M, November 1 Mic, operated by the Algonquin Amateur Radio Club in celebration of the 350th anniversary of Marlborough, Massachusetts. It actually begins 0 Zulu June 25 through July 5 on 7.250 and 14.250 megahertz. W3ACH from the 24th Annual Chambers Fest Festival in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, is scheduled for July 17 on 7.260 or 14.260 MHz single sideband, plus or minus URM or noise. The call W3C commemorating 100 years of powerboat racing in Cambridge, Maryland. That's July 22 through 25 on 7.200, 14.250, 21.250, and 28.350 megahertz. Special event call K4F, Kilo 4 Foxtrot, from the 39th Annual Smithville Fiddlers Jamboree and Crafts Festival in Smithville, Tennessee, DeKalb County Amateur Radio Club. That's scheduled for the July the 3rd, which is only 3 days away. Call W9ZL from the AEE Air Venture 2010 in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, Fox City's Amateur Radio Club, July 28 to August 1st. Now here's a list of a few ham fests, sort of like flea markets for amateur radio. July 3rd, again, just several days away, Eastern Pennsylvania ARRL Section Convention and Firecracker Hamfest, Marysville Lions Park, Marysville, Pennsylvania. July 9 through 11, International Hamfest, CCC Lodge, U.S. side of the International Peace Garden, access from Dencius, North Dakota, or south from Boisson Vane, Manitoba, Canada. July 10, South Milwaukee Amateur Radio Club's 42nd Annual Swap Fest. It's being held at the American Legion Post number 434, Oak Creek, Wisconsin. Also on the test, the 2010 TARS, T-A-R-S, Hamfest, Doyle Convention Center, Texas City, Texas. That's the Tidelands Amateur Radio Society. July 17, Pikes Peak Radio Amateur Association Ham Radio Megafest, Lewis Palmer High School, Monument, Colorado. Also on the 17th, Pioneer Amateur Radio Club's 13th Annual Flea Market, St. Charles Parish Center, North Bend, Nebraska. On July 18, Mid-Atlantic ARC's Valley Forge Hamfest, Kimberton Fire Company Fairgrounds, Kimberton, Pennsylvania. Also on the 18th, Maryland Hamfest and Computer Fest, Howard County Fairgrounds, it's off I-70, at Route 32 to Baltimore Radio Amateur Television Society. July 23-24, the 35th Annual Ham Holiday, 2010, Biltmore Hotel, Conference Center, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. And for August 1st, the 60th Annual Berryville Hamfest, Clark County Ruritan Fairgrounds, Berryville, Virginia, in the beautiful Shenandoah Valley. Well, folks, you recall a few minutes ago, as I was reading the editor's commentaries, Rick Marshall noted the fact that Robert R. Brown, called NM7M, has become a silent key. His article appears on page 18. I'm going to read that for you. As Solar Cycle 24 finally begins its climb, contributor Bob Brown reminisces on the granddaddy of all solar cycles so far, a half century ago, and how it helped shape his career and his contributions to our hobby. The piece is titled Over Coffee and Cognac by Robert R. Brown, NM7M. It was nice of you to come by today. It gets sort of lonely with only a TV for company. I'm lucky it doesn't talk back. Anyway, being bedridden 24/7, I really miss being on the air. However, I gather it's been pretty dull with solar minimum. 50 years ago, it was wild and crazy, working the world with 5 watts and a wet noodle. That's when we learned how radio really works. Looking back to 1956, I was teaching in New Mexico when it all began with the solar flare of February 23 in 1956. We learned about it on television from no less a person than the Royal Astronomer of Great Britain, Sir Thomas Gold. All his reports of weird atmospheric phenomena and radio events told me that it was a big deal. I knew enough physics to know the real action had to be at high altitudes and polar latitudes. However, I was stuck at mountain altitudes and low latitude. Clearly, a change in employment was called for if I was going to get in the game. Therefore, I prepared a research proposal as well as my resume and made the rounds in circles with deeper pockets than where I was at the time. It didn't take long. My alma mater, UC Berkeley, had a position open because of an impending retirement and offered it to me. The pay was better, but I had to pay for moving. They offered to support my research, so with my wife and year-old twins, I headed for Berkeley and research in the high latitudes. The first year was spent teaching a course on atomic physics, gathering a small group, a program, and good technician, and I started building payloads for July 1959 in Alaska. We built a cosmic ray detector with a counter telescope for vertical cosmic rays, a gamma ray counter, and an omnidirectional detector. All that had to be under 12 pounds to keep the FAA happy. We hoped that such a small scheme would give a good sample of what was up there, whether quiet or active. When done, we flew Pan Am to Fairbanks, descending on the Geophysical Institute at College, and set up shop on an open field between it and the USGS, the United States Geological Survey, Magnetic Observatory. We needed running room to launch balloon trains over 100 feet long. It was a perfect setup in every direction. No sooner had we checked out a couple of payloads and had the telemetry station in good order, that word came from the Geographical Institute. Fly now, the sun is flaring. We took a quick look at the data, were convinced, and got a payload in the air ASAP. I listened to the blops and bleeps of the telemetry. We knew our rig was in a big radiation event. It was much higher in intensity than the earlier 56 event because our rig was only a few millibars below the top of the atmosphere sampling primary flare particles. The sun kept flaring, and we had a balloon in the air continuously. We were there to collect data. Serious analysis could wait until things calmed down. However, we did take a peek at each of the channels to see how they were working. All seemed okay. But the gamma channel looked odd. A couple of flights were exactly the same. We then concluded we were seeing nuclear gamma rays at low altitudes due to excited states from PN reactions, noted by the abundant flare radiation, just as Professor S. F. Singer had predicted earlier in the preprint widely circulated. Not wanting the folks at Berkeley to think we'd be coming home empty-handed, I sent word home about the gamma rays for local consumption. A week later, I got a news clipping from the San Francisco Chronicle saying, UC Prof finds dangerous rays over Alaska. That wasn't the end of it, as I got a letter from a Swiss air pilot enclosing a $5 bill and asking for more information about gamma rays at aircraft altitudes. All I could do was send him back his money and say there were more gamma rays where those came from. The aerospace industry got the idea, though, and installed, even used, radiation detectors on the Concords. We launched our last flight just when the sun flared for the third and final time. The ascent data yielded the counting rate versus atmospheric depth, easily converted to energy, with the range energy curve for air. With a modest correction for time variation, Bob Weir, my programmer, had all the makings for his dissertation when he got back. He had use of the ionization profile from the balloon ascent to predict the ionospheric absorption of cosmic radio noise due to the solar protons. After the February 23 event in 1956, the 1959 event would be news. The same would be true of the gamma ray data, Ray D'Arcy's topic for analysis. All in all, we did very well in our first effort. I hope we could be half as lucky next time. We had to start new payloads while getting our results ready for publication. While my budget would be drained paying for new payloads, our work drew attention in Europe, and I was invited to present our results at the Swedish Academy Symposium in September of 1960. Happily, the Academy would publish the papers given at the symposium, sparing my budget of page charges. The summer of 1960 went very well in Alaska with the new, startling result, the observation of an intense burst of X-rays at the sudden commencement of a magnetic storm. This happened shortly after noon, and the first reaction was to attribute it to trapped electrons in the Van Allen belt being jiggled out by a blast of plasma from the sun. Simple enough? Question mark. A complication developed, though. Hans Ortner of the Kiruna Observatory was in Alaska, and seeing the data, he fired off a telex, asking what was observed across the polar cap at the same time. Back came the answer. The rheometer showed the same thing. Now, how does one explain that? 12 hours away in local time? Too tough. It could wait, and it was only one example anyway. My trip to the Swedish Symposium went well enough, as my first trip to Europe. A good part of the anxiety of going via a commercial airliner wasn't there, as I went via MATS, that's the Military Air Transport Service. You folks remember that, especially you guys, don't you? I do. Both ways, and had good sessions with GIs along the way, like I had never left home. The SAS flight north to Kiruna seemed cold and austere by comparison, but after a couple of hours, I was there, 100 kilometers above the Arctic Circle. There were about 40 people attending the symposium, with every ionospheric interest represented. The first day was spent getting acquainted, and then the symposium got underway. All in all, I made three brief presentations. Summaries of Bob Weir's PCA, that's polar cap absorption work, Ray Diarchy's nuclear gamma rays during a PCA event, and my X-rays at the SC and similar activity across the polar cap. Bob Weir's topic drew the greatest interest, mine the least. It took 2 days for all the papers to be given, and each night they had a banquet for the attendees. Being very junior in the field, I made the second round. I was lucky, as the persons to my right and left spoke perfect English. The one to my left was Dr. Alv England, the deputy director of the observatory, and when the meal was over, he rose and made the rounds, socializing with the guests. To my right was Dr. John B. Gregory, the thin, lean English type often seen in New Zealand. John was an F region specialist with close to 20 years in the field. To hear him talk, he'd seen about all the F region had to offer. Anyway, he chose to pick on me and my presentation while we enjoyed a cup of coffee and a snifter of good French cognac. He didn't waste any time, saying my event was quite clear and spectacular, but told me not to have any high hopes of a repeat anytime soon. His argument was statistical, saying that SCs and sudden impulses are just too rare in the scheme of things. I had to agree, but he went on suggesting a better approach would be looking for large oral events between conjugate points. I remember something about the conjugate points of a lens from geometrical optics in my student days, but finding them in the ionosphere had me stumped until John explained it. There were points connected by magnetic field lines. He said Harry Vestine of the Rand Corporation had published an extensive calculation in the JGR, that's the Journal of Geophysical Research, mapping field lines. John even rattled off a number of conjugate pairs from Vestine's paper. His argument was that flying balloons from conjugate points near auroral latitudes had a better chance of success, since aurora are so common and intense auroral events are not infrequent. I think his arguments are supported by old wives' tales from history about aurora simultaneously appearing in both hemispheres. They had to be big events to attract that much attention. Now, folks, the author goes on at length to talk about Macquarie Island, stating that I don't think it was a cognac, but I came away from that conversation with Macquarie Island and Alaska foremost in my mind. It would take a grant, someone to handle the Alaska end, and some good activity to pull it off. But I was optimistic we could do it. When I got back to California, I'd learned that Kinsey Anderson, a veteran ballooner from Minnesota, would join us at Berkeley. That solved the problem of the Alaska end, while my group would be on Macquarie Island. The author goes on to conclude that this shows how radio really works. Particle fluxes giving the ionization that makes single sideband on polar paths flutter or be heavily absorbed. This type of event has its origin in, quoting, an accelerator in the magnetotail, close quote. Not any shock-driven process such as the SC event that started this. Now, if you as the listener is interested in more specific details regarding the author's take on this whole matter, the article appears on page 18, 19, 20, and 21 It gives an awful lot of technical detail plus charts and illustrations. You should have someone help you read it if it really gets your attention. And in his memory, we thank Robert Brown, NM7M, for his work for many years in science and amateur radio. Folks, I've got the results of the 2010 CQWPX-RTTY contest. It's all here in blazing detail, authored by Ed Munns, M-U-N-S, call W0YK, Whiskey Zero, Yankee Kilo. 16th annual CQWPX-RTTY contest once again broke the participation record with 2,404 submitted logs, up 16% from last year's record number, which was up 11% from 2007. The number of different call signs logged was similar to last year's number, around 16,000. However, there were over 1 million QSOs, 27% more than in 2009, compared to an 8% increase from 2007 to 2008, partially due to relatively good propagation conditions across 80 through 15 meters, with a bit more activity on 10 meters than we've seen in recent years. The money band for QSO points was 40 meters. 170 countries appeared across all logs. 65% of the QSOs in the submitted logs were made by stations who made a total of less than 500 QSOs. 23% of the QSOs in the submitted logs were made with stations who did not submit a log and averaged less than 18 QSOs. There were 13,600 participants not listed in the line scores because they didn't submit logs, but who are always important to the success of the contest. Participants interested in maximizing contacts and perhaps new multis for various awards were most rewarded on 20 and 15 meters. Those who sought to maximize their score made sure they got everything they could out of 40 meters, where half the QSO rate nets the same points as the high bands. Single ops, limited to 30 hours, had to strategically apply their time as one of their operating skills in the contest. For most, it was beneficial to be on 40 meters whenever it was open, supplementing with 80 meters depending on rate and station capabilities. As the solar flux rises, the high bands will become more effective despite their half-point value, and conversely, the low bands will become less effective. All of this resulted in 11 new world records and 35 new continental records. What a wonderful tribute to the continued growth of RTTY, that's radio teletype, contesting with increasing numbers of both new and veteran contesters embracing the RTTY mode. For those of you who are listening to this recording and are interested in the absolute results published in the July 2010 CQ magazine, the article begins on page 22 and goes through all kinds of detail relative to scores, finishes, categorically and otherwise, all the way to page 27. Go to it. And if you do track down this issue of the magazine, there's also an announcement there about the 2010 inductees into the CQ Amateur Radio Contest and DX Halls of Fame. Quite a few fine operators are given that privilege. I won't take the time to give you their names, but you might find it interesting yourself. Not only are their names listed, their call signs, of course, some are silent keys, but it also gives you a brief summarization of what they became so well noted for. And moving along now, there is also the announcement for the 2010 CQ Worldwide RTTY-DX contest, which will be between September 25 and 26 this year. It starts at 0 GMT, Greenwich Mean Time, Saturday, and ends at 2400 GMT on Sunday, September 26, 2010. Changing the subject, if you're really interested in what vanity call signs are all about, then what is this regulatory fee thing? In Washington Rito, by author Fred O. May at W5YI, he spells it all out in detail for you. He concludes with the vanity call sign fee has varied over the years, from a low of $11.70 in 2007 to a high of $70, as first proposed in the 1993 Budget Reconciliation Act. Again, it fluctuates based on the amount of funding Congress tells the FCC it must recover. Also, the vanity regulatory fee is not based and cannot be based on the cost to provide or renew the call sign. Let's take a look now at Public Service by Richard Fisher, KI6SN. The lull before the storms. WX4NHC puts amateurs in focus at National Hurricane Conference. With a heightened awareness of the critical need for disaster communications preparedness in the wake of the Haiti earthquake, an unprecedented crowd of more than 100 gathered for the amateur radio forum hosted by the National Hurricane Center's WX4NHC during the 2010 National Hurricane Conference in Orlando, Florida. Attendance for the main session on March 30 was the largest in the history of amateur radio forum, according to Julia Ripoli, WD4R, a volunteer operator at WX4NHC for 30 years, and its assistant coordinator. During the lull before the 2010 Atlantic hurricane season, which runs from June 1 to November 30, representatives of the station presented amateur radio disaster communications before, during, and after hurricanes, and opened the forum to all radio amateurs free of charge. The majority in attendance were ham operators involved in or interested in emergency communications, Ripoli said. Emergency managers, meteorologists, and government officials participated in the session as well. This was the first time that this forum was attended simultaneously by previous Hurricane Center Director Max Mayfield and current NHC Director Bill Reed, called WB5FYA, WD4R said. The article goes on to talk about the station WX4NHC taking to the air for hurricane pre-season station testing. And there was information about a lesson learned that when VHF conditions get goofy, you should go simplex and lay off the repeaters. The German Skywarn team schedules a visit to Oklahoma's Tornado Alley. Members of the German Skywarn team organized a visit to the United States in May as part of their training in storm spotting. According to Andres Colmar, DG8SBR team coordinator, a tour of Oklahoma's Tornado Valley was scheduled through the month under plans coordinated by German Skywarn Vice Chairman Ingor Berlin and Sven Lucke, Chairman. The Oklahoma Emergency Management Radio Club granted permission to the licensed operators on the German team to use the call WX5EM, a club call sign, while in the United States. Also, there's a request here. Wanted: your stories of amateur radio public service. How have you, or has your MCOM group, contributed to the ever-expanding portfolio of amateur radio public service? We'd like to hear about it. Whether it's been in a real-life emergency, disaster preparedness training, recruiting in the MCOM ranks, or in support of community activities, many of us have stories to tell. Sharing those experiences not only credits those who step forward to become involved, but also gives other responders perspective on how they might do things better or differently in the future. We welcome stories focusing on new equipment, initiatives, and procedures as well. As much as we're interested in hearing about the now, there's a lot to be learned from the then as well, looking back on radio amateurs' long and distinguished MCOM history. Please take a moment to drop us a line about your emergency communications activities, present, past, or future. Via email, you can write to call KI6SN at CQ-amateur-radio.com, or through the U.S. Postal Service. You can mail to 1940 Weatherly Way, Riverside, California. That's 19400 Wetherly, Weatherly, Way, W-A-Y, Riverside, California, C-A, zip code 92506. We'll take it from there. This digested commentary was filed by Richard Fisher, KI6SN, in his public service column presentation in the July 2010 issue of CQ Magazine. I'm going to sort of conclude this recording this month with contesting by John Doerr, D-O-R-R. John's call is K1AR. It's titled, How to Improve Your Single Sideband Contesting Skills. It seems that much more has been written over the years about improving one's CW skills than single sideband operating, CW being Morse code. Perhaps this is based on the assumption that CW is more difficult operating mode. After all, on single sideband SSB, the skill is simply to talk fast and with clarity, right? As you'll see this month, nothing could be further from the truth. I believe that more training is possible for single sideband challenged operator than for one who has problems with CW. One reason is that virtually all of us begin life with an ability to talk and speak a language. CW operating adds the complexity of learning the code before you even consider proficiency. While it's clear that some contesters seem to have God-given talents, there's plenty of opportunity to improve anyone's skills. When considering single sideband operating proficiency, a few skill categories come to mind. Calling CQ, timing, phonetics, and a myriad of miscellaneous topics. With these subjects in mind, let's dive in. Starting with calling CQ. The act of calling CQ seems simple enough, yet it is a skill in and of itself in the world of contesting. Consider one of the main goals of contesting. To make as many QSOs in a short period of time as possible. Having said that, does it make sense to call CQ contests like you would if you were DXing on a Tuesday afternoon? Calling an effective contest, CQ requires several attributes. They include brevity, clarity, emphasis on your call sign, energy, and speed that reflects the condition of the time. Let's unpack each of these areas in some detail. There's rarely, if ever, a scenario in which a long-winded CQ becomes a productive strategy in a single sideband contest. Remember, the longer you're transmitting, the longer you're not working someone. Many stations will simply tune right by you, especially if you don't have one of the bigger signals on the band. Energy and speed go hand in hand when CQing. A station is much more likely to call you if you show some animation in your voice. Make it sound like you're really into the event when you're transmitting, even when you're exhausted. This approach is infectious and will draw stations to your calls. Speed is part of this equation as well. If you have a snappy approach to operating, the favor will be returned by most stations. Also, on rare occasions, it does sometimes pay to slow things down a little. Especially when you're trying to attract calls from rare, unusual multipliers or geographic areas that may not be operating competitively in the contest. Regarding timing, well, they say in life that timing is everything, and so it is with contest operating too. Timing and pileups has as much to do with eventually working another station as does your signal strength. My experience in phone pileups is that short calls with small breaks in between is one of the best operating methods you can use to be successful. It's rare that you ever need to sign the other guy's call. After all, he already knows that. Every pileup has its own characteristics. There's a kind of ocean wave effect to most pileups that is timing opportunity for you. The secret of effective calling in phone pileups, and CW for that matter, is to call when others are not. If the pileup is big, delay the start of your call by a second or two. You want to be the person whose call sign hangs out at the end of a series of calls so that the other station can say, something off a radio, you're 5934. Tail ending is another operating technique unto itself. Simply put, It is a calling method whereby you sign your call at the end of another person's CUSO. You have to dance a fine line of acceptable calling procedure, with the guideline being that you never eradicate information the other station is trying to copy. For example, call sign, exchange, etc. That's one certain way you'll end up not working them. Telany begins by trying to get a feel as to whether the other station accepts that kind of operating procedure. Ultimately, there's really only one way to find out, and that is to try to see if it works, or if you get yelled at. Just as with any pile-up situation, the secret is very simple. Get your call sign heard when others are not calling. Now, relative to the use of phonetics. The use of phonetics seems so simple, yet many operators are poor at its application. Always remember why we use phonetics on single sideband. It's not so that we can sound cute or cool, but so that we can help the other station copy our call sign correctly. For that reason alone, always use common words for phonetics. The standard Alpha Bravo Charlie phonetic list was created for just that reason. Another common error in use of phonetics is that we sometimes get stuck in a rut with our word choices. For example, I tend to be a Kilo 1 Alpha radio kind of guy. That's his call sign, K1AR. Never forget to change the phonetics you are using if you're having trouble working someone. Your word choice may be a challenge to the non-English-speaking operator, or it just may not break through a pileup as well as another selection. Consider the trade-offs for phonetics choices, such as United versus Union, or Easy versus Echo, or Germany versus Gulf. Sharp, ear-piercing words are almost always more effective in phone operating. As you can imagine, I've only scratched the surface of phone operating techniques. Hopefully, you'll gain some insight that will improve your next contest score. I'd like to hear about some of the tangible results that you obtained from this discussion. See you in the next contest. Signed, 73 John, K1AR. Included in this article, How to Improve Your Single Sideband Contesting Skills, is a calendar of events. If you point your antenna down towards Central America, or thereabouts, July 3rd and 4th, Venezuelan Independence Day Contest. Also July 3 and 4, the DXRTTY Contest. That's a German contest. July 10 and 11, the IARUHF High Frequency Championship. Also that date, July 10, 11, WRTC 2010 Competition. And a big one, especially regarding CQ Magazine here, July 17, 18, CQ Worldwide VHF Contest. Also on 17, 18 July, North American RTTY CUSO Party. On July 24, 25, RSGB IOTA Contest. And going into August, August 1, SARL HF Phone Contest. August 7th, European HF Championship. August 7 and 8, ARRL UHF contest. Obviously, there are lots of opportunities to either listen in on a lot of conversation on the ham bands throughout the world, or certainly, and perhaps more fun, to participate if you're qualified. Well, folks, this is Bob, N1BLF. I'm going to wind up this month's recording and digest format of CQ Magazine for July 2010. CQ is a publication of CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It's for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may be reached at area 763-520-0512, or at email address handyham@courage.org. Our website, which is maintained daily, is www.handyham.org. Also, a bit more information for you, more specific perhaps as to how to contact Pat Tice, the director, and the secretary who deals with a lot of the office material. They have recently changed to Camp Courage, the Handy Ham system, 8046 83rd Street Northwest, Maple Lake, Minnesota, MN 55358. To contact Pat Tice directly, you could call area 763-520-0511 or the office, talking to Nancy, area 763-520-0512. Both Nancy and Pat get their calls or voicemails at those numbers, no matter where they're working. I want to thank you again for listening along with me here on the Courage Handy Ham System. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo, Lima, Foxtrot. Remember those phonetics I was talking about? Hi, hi. You know, incidentally, if anybody wishes to contact me directly via email, you're perfectly welcome to do so. My email is my call sign, nblf@comcast.net. Thanks a lot. 73s from Dartmouth, Massachusetts, N1BLF.